Up at the window of the tower, there was a wise maiden who thought within herself that the knight had not undertaken the battle either on her account or for the sake of the common herd who had gathered about the list, but that his only incentive had been the queen. And she thought that if he knew that she was at the window seeing and watching him, his strength and courage would increase. And if she had known his name, she would gladly have called him to look about him. Then she came to the queen and said, "Lady, for God's sake, and your own as well as ours, I beseech you to tell me if you know the name of yonder knight, to the end that it may be of some help to him." "Damsel," the queen replies, "you have asked me a question in which I see no hate or evil, but rather good intent. The name of the knight, I know, is Lancelot of the Lake." "God, how happy and glad at heart I am," the damsel says. Then she leans forward and calls to him by name so loudly that all the people hear, "Lancelot, turn about and see who is here taking note of thee." So appears Sir Lancelot in his first starring role in literature in the 12th century narrative, Lancelot, the Knight of the Cart. And from the beginning, we can see a love triangle starting to take shape. It turns out that medieval times had plenty of those love triangles. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is the University of the Year.
How did the Christian writers of medieval times rework stories of love triangles from antiquity? What does the outcome of these love triangles tell us about the values of the times they come from? And what do these stories tell us about the force of love? Our guest, once again, is Thomas Dubois, professor in the Department of Scandinavian Studies at the UW-Madison.
Welcome back to University of the Air.
Hello, I'm glad to be here.
As we come up on Valentine's Day, I think we see Cupids, we kind of think about where all kinds of ideas of love come from. Can you take us back to the ancient Greeks and give us some sense of different concepts of love that we've inherited?
Well, there's, in the classical world, all sorts of elaborate concepts concerning love and concerning human relations. And in fact, the classic texts are full of fantastically interesting works about human relations, sexual relations, relations between men and women, relations between men and men, relations between women and women. And we, one of the things that I find interesting as a medievalist is to remember that we have those texts because they were carefully and diligently copied by monks during the Middle Ages who lived in a culture that supposedly renounced sex and was turning away from the body and saw the body as a source of danger and corruption that would lead to eternal damnation. So there they are within that framework of diligent renunciation of the body, writing the poems of Sappho or the really pornographic poetry of Catullus and examining those concepts. And I think out of that cognitive dissonance comes all sorts of stories that become kind of a medieval version of these narratives that were inherited from the classical world. And we have figures like Adonis and Eros, and we have notions of amor and caritas, these terms in Latin and in Greek that are brought into the medieval culture and given a Christian coding, but also allowed in some ways to remain just as troublesome and just as energetic as they were in the classic world.
Where do we get this, the sort of sense of courtliness that we associate with knighthood, where the lady, the object of the affection, is put up on a pedestal?
Well, as in the poem that you started with, where we have Guinevere up in a tower, the role of women within medieval state structure was to be a link between realms and also to be a link between a king and his court. So it was her job to make sure that the relationships were good, that there was plenty of loyalty among the men for the king, and that any bad feelings were dissipated, and also that by her very marriage to the king, she linked usually different kingdoms and different important men of power. So in order to keep her in this role, you had to be very careful about who she is consorted with and just how friendly she got with the men around her. And in the medieval texts, we often see that the king is aging, he's fought a lot of battles, and now he has time to get married. And so he has a young wife, he's aging, and he has all these young men who are like Sir Lancelot, very strapping, very dashing, very capable, and themselves not married. And it is the queen's job to keep them happy, but also to keep them respecting her in a certain way.
Keep them in their place.
To keep them in their place, and also to keep herself kind of unsullied by their attentions.
Easier for some than others. I mean, I think of Beowulf, for example, when you mentioned the queen sort of being the liaison between the king and the court and keeping them happy, but keeping their distance. Now, I always imagined Wealhtheow as being somewhat older than love triangle age anyway, but she literally is serving the court. I mean, she's pouring drinks, isn't she?
That's right. She is bringing the horn, the drinking horn, from man to man and making sure that they're happy, giving them gifts, and they're getting progressively drunker and drunker in this process. But it is her role to do that. And Beowulf has arrived in the court, and he has solved this huge issue that her aging husband has had, which is that this monster Grendel comes every night and destroys somebody that he catches there. And this has caused all kinds of problems for Hrothgar for apparently decades. And along comes Beowulf, and in the course of a single night, he gets rid of that whole problem. He destroys this monster, Grendel. Later on, it turns out to be another monster as well, but that's a different part of the epic. And Wealhtheow realizes that this guy could easily take over the kingdom if he wanted to. He's younger, he's powerful, he's proven himself capable. And so she wants to make sure that she turns his attentions towards her sons and makes sure that he's going to be loyal to them and uphold their right
to the kingdom.
To the kingdom and to the inheritance that they'll take over.
So that's a success story in terms of love triangles.
Well, it's
unlike something like Helen of Troy.
It's exactly. It's a love triangle that doesn't happen because Beowulf listens to the queen and she exhorts him to treat the sons well and to be loyal, and he does so and goes back to his own kingdom where he becomes a king and everything works out well. I actually have the scene in which the queen does that, if you want to hear that. My emeritus colleague Dick Ringler did this wonderful translation of Beowulf, a translation for oral delivery, and he tries to capture that kind of that moment. And we have Wealhtheow serving Beowulf, and she says, "Dear Beowulf, duly enjoy these great treasures, this gold-rimmed robe, this precious collar. Prosper always, glorying in strength, and give these boys your wise counsel. Be good to my boys and act in their interest, triumphant hero. Everyone here honors his comrades and loves his lord with a loyal heart. That nation is united, and its noble thanes drink merrily and do as I bid them." She returned to her place.
And she never is tempted by this young, powerful.
She's not tempted as far as the epic tells us.
And neither is he, so far as we know.
Yes.
Yeah. That's unusual with these triangles.
Well, it is. And it must have been plenty of times in medieval life where temptation occurred or where things got out of hand.
And how would the concept of the different kinds of love, erotic love versus something else, can you break down the different kinds of love as it would have been understood?
Well, the medieval theology had to deal with this fact that humans have love and they have physical attraction. And the way to do that in medieval theology was to kind of bifurcate the whole system and say that there's a love that was bodily, which we often talk about with the term eros, the Greek term for the god. who is physical love and attraction. And then we have this more platonic caritas, this notion of love that's out of proper spirit and that's on a purely wholesome level. And in this way, the medieval world tried to grapple with these two sides of the very human process of attraction.
And where would Cupid have fit in?
Well, Cupid is an interesting character because he's also a god. He's a Roman god, the son of Venus, and he is a god that creates this attraction, that his arrows are what smite people, and then they suddenly fall in love with somebody against their will, often in the narratives that we have.
And that's with the erotic love.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And a love that gets out of hand and that turns in bad directions for everyone involved.
One thing that's always struck me in classical mythology is just how lecherous Zeus is. You know, how many shapes he takes, how many actions. You know, to make the king of the gods, the highest god, be such a, you know, adulterer and such a creative cheater.
In the narratives that we have, nobody comes off good. The old men are lecherous. The young men are sometimes very, very heroic, but also betray their king. And the queens are sometimes good-willed, but often give in to their own affections and emotional needs. And I think that the texts explore all of those very complex human relations. Because one of the things that happens is that we know socially, here's what I ought to do, but then on some other level, because of Cupid's arrows, because of this attraction, here's what I'm going to do instead. And it goes in a very different direction.
Well, I'm reminded a little bit just briefly of, you know, the scene in Sir Gawain and the Green Knight where the lady of the house actually comes in, offers herself bodily to him when he's doing a night there, and he says, "Well, all right, how about just a kiss?"
That's right.
And
That's
the result is that instead of getting his head chopped off later by her husband, he just gets a nick. So that's one case where there was at least a little bit of a compromise there. But are there other instances, I assume, where the queen as the peace giver fails?
There's lots of cases. And there's a really great one from the Welsh Mabinogion, the second branch of that, the daughter of the King Llyr, who's named Branwen. And she's supposed to be the peace weaver between the Isle of the Mighty, which is Wales in England, and Ireland. And it works out terribly badly.
tell us the story.
Well, the King of Ireland, Matholwch, comes to Wales and asks the king, Bendigeidfran, for his sister. And this is a very good match, and Bendigeidfran says yes. But he doesn't consult with his half-brother, Efnisien. And Efnisien is really angry that he hasn't been consulted over the marriage. So after the wedding takes place, Efnisien sneaks out and he mutilates the horses of Matholwch. This is a tremendous insult, a dishonor. And it completely destroys the basis for this good marriage that's supposed to happen and this uniting of the kingdoms. And at that point, Matholwch doesn't really know what to do, but Bendigeidfran patches things up, and in the end, he sends his sister off with Matholwch, and things seem like they're going to work out fine. But after about a year, it doesn't. Doesn't happen that way. They keep on remembering what's happened to those horses. And in the end, what they do is they, instead of having Branwen do this very fine role of attending people and giving them drinks, they make her become the cook at the court. And she has to labor in the kitchen producing all the food. And then the butcher every night is supposed to come in and punch her in the ear. And this way, she becomes the proxy victim. They can't get back at Bendigeidfran, so they attack his sister instead.
I'm trying to find the moral in that story.
Well, the moral is that these ideal matches don't always work out, and sometimes they fail in a terrible way. And in fact, what happens in that story is that what is Branwen supposed to do? She's being treated terribly. So she raises a little starling and she teaches it to recognize her brother and sends it flying off to England to find him and to tell him what's going on. Because Matholwch knows that if Bendigeidfran finds out, he's going to send an army to save his sister. And so Matholwch has cut off all contact between Ireland and Wales. So there's no ships going across. So Branwen has got this idea of sending a bird. Bendigeidfran comes with his army. In fact, he's so large that he wades across the Irish Sea. And thousands of people die on both sides in this massive battle. And Bendigeidfran himself is killed. In the end, they take his head and return with it to England. And Branwen, along with only seven other people, return to the island. And when she gets back, she looks at England and she looks back at Ireland. And the story tells us that she says, "Alas that I was ever born, that I have become the death of so many men in two great kingdoms." And then she dies of sorrow.
Oh, boy.
Now, the story of Tristan and Isolde, or Isolde, as it would have been, yes, in operatic circles, when we get into the 19th century, at least, it's a conflict between Christian love and erotic love, or Christian duty and erotic love. Is that the source of the story?
Well, that is one of these Celtic love stories that then travel out to the rest of Europe. And in, I think one of the interesting things about that story is that how do you make sure that this physical love, eros, and this proper love, caritas, come together in the right way. And the trick is to have a love potion. So you find the two people who are supposed to get married, and they each drink from this love potion. They look at each other, and then they'll be in love, and everything will work out the way it's supposed to. But, of course, what happens in the story is that Tristan and the young man who's supposed to go fetch Isolde and bring her back to King Mark happens to drink of the love potion with Isolde, and then they fall in love with each other.
And then they have the perfect excuse. It's not really their fault. It wasn't really adultery
fault
that you can prosecute, because it was the potion's fault.
It's due to the potion. Due to the potion. But it leads to the same terrible end, because, of course, Mark is angry. They enter into an adulterous relationship, and the kingdom is destroyed as a result.
What about earlier triangles, even from the Bible, such as with King David?
Well, yes, absolutely. The Christian scriptures were not devoid of love triangles either. And we have the wonderful story of King David and his being smitten with Bathsheba. And this was a really important text for medieval theologians to think about, because we have King David, who is the ancestor of Jesus and the great king of all time in Jewish history, sending Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, into battle and saying, when it's a really bad moment in the battle, everybody else hang back so that Uriah gets killed. So we have this double crossing of this king actually giving in to his basest motives and getting that way this wife for himself.
And being struck by her beauty when she's bathing?
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, if it's not going to be Cupid's arrow, that will do.
Yes.
That's the old bathing scene.
Well, there is this recurrent feature in a lot of the medieval stuff that the eye is the way in which the poison enters into the body, that it's through the eyes that we are captured by love. And that is something that certainly happens in the David story.
The complexities of love. We're going to look at Valentine's and where do we get the traditions we have when we return in a moment with the University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Thomas Dubois. We're looking at medieval love triangles. There is a strong connection, obviously, between medieval times and the classical times which came before them. But I'm wondering then, how does St. Valentine fit in? Classical figure, but does he carry into the Middle Ages? And if so, how?
Well, St. Valentine is a fascinating character because he was an incredibly important saint in the medieval period. And it just so happens that his feast day, 14th of February, is exactly at the same time as in the classical world, there was a very important fertility ritual. That was the Lupercalia, which was all about making sure that fertility would be carried on in the next generation. And so it's pretty clear that Valentine is a Christianization of the pre-Christian love rituals that happened. Valentine does it so interesting. At least we have a story about him. The king has told this young soldier that he shouldn't get married and that he's not allowed to get married. And yet this young man is in love, and Valentine helps him. He gives him some money so that he can actually have the marriage that he was hoping to have. And so it is Valentine helping marriage over the express directives of a king that leads to the problems.
So getting a love relation over the stumbling blocks. He's a kind of a facilitator of love.
He's a facilitator of love.
So maybe that's the link to our own time, is we have Hallmark and florists being the facilitators of love. I was just trying to think of how many rituals and things we do, you know, with little cupids and little heart-shaped things where we don't necessarily know the origin or that the February 14th date goes all the way back to the classical times, but we sort of just go through these things without knowing the past.
Yeah, and I think that also what makes Valentine such an interesting holiday in the modern world is that it is the one moment where we say, let's talk about our relationships and our attractions and let's celebrate
ourselves.
Those.
Yes,
yes. Mm-hmm. And you have Valentine's Day dances and moments where people get to ask somebody that they hadn't necessarily had the guts to ask for a dance before. And in fact, in medieval Europe, because on leap year, there was actually a very important event that happened on leap year that's connected to Valentine's Day in a kind of strange way. And it's what sometimes is called the Sadie Hawkins tradition, because when leap year was instituted, we think of it as an extra day added to the end of February. But actually, the extra day is added on Valentine's Day on the 14th. And then it pushes the length of that month out to have an extra day. The 29th. So on the 14th of February, it's okay for a woman to ask a man to marry her.
If things weren't progressing quickly enough.
That's right.
If it had been four years.
That's
the last leap year.
If the man refused, he had till the leap year's day, the 29th, to give her some kind of compensation, like a nice dress or a coat or something.
A consolation prize,
yeah.
The relationship between, and this is, I guess, the most famous of all these love triangles, Tom, between Lancelot and Guinevere, or if you want to say among Lancelot, Guinevere, and King Arthur.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Well, this is one of the really classic Celtic love stories, that there's all within Irish, Welsh, Cornish, and Manx tradition, there's a whole set of these love triangle stories, and they're always the same. They're always about an older king, a young and very bold warrior, and a young wife or young wife-to-be for the king. And it always works out to the destruction of all three of them.
That always works out that way?
Pretty much always. There are some variations in which sometimes, for instance, in the story of old Finn, the Irish hero, and his young wife, Grania, and the love interest, Jeremid. In that story, Jeremid and Grania get together and have to flee Finn. He chases them all over Ireland, and in fact, all over Ireland there are these dolmens. They must have been in the ancient times some kind of altar, because they're three huge stones with another flat stone put on top of them. And in the Finn tradition, these are called the bed of Janemund and Grania. So this is the place where they spent the night. And at some point, while fleeing, they have lots and lots of children. And in the end, they also get happily married and live the rest of their adult lives very well that way, until finally, very late in life, Finn gives in to his anger and invites Janemund on a hunt. And they go on this hunt, and that leads to Janemund's death, and Janemund is dying, and he can be cured if Finn gives him a drink and touches it with his thumb, because Finn's thumb has curing properties. But he refuses until Janemund dies, because he remembers that you stole my wife.
What are some of the, some of the messages or the emotions that are coming through? Obviously, envy, this sense of youth that's fading, a loss of potency and so on. But what are some of the things when you look at these texts, including the Guinevere and Lancelot one, or some of the other ones that you've been talking about? What do you see the writers or tellers of these tales kind of working through?
Well, there's the duty that one has to one's kingdom, to one's station in life, to the relationships that have been prescribed. And then there are the duties to one's heart and the natural urgings of one's heart. And though that conflict is hard to deal with when they don't work together. And I think that the texts really explore those conflicts and what can occur.
It seems as if quite often the women in these stories are something of victims, in the sense that they get punished for things they had no control over. They get put in situations and then punished for the results.
Yeah, that certainly is the case with the story of Naois and Deirdre and their old king, who is Connachar. So old King Connachar, young and strapping Naois, and then Deirdre. Because Deirdre is born prophesied that she's going to lead to all kinds of war. It's not her fault. She's born just has this fated that this is going to happen to her. And from the moment of her birth, the curse or this fate starts to take control, because Connachar hears about this prophecy and says, all the men say, let's just put her to death right now, because then we won't have any of this trouble.
Right, yeah. That starts to sound like something out of Greek drama, though, doesn't it?
Yes, it's
you're
absolutely
fated to do this, and yes, you can try to resist, but you're going to end up
but it's going to happen
going right
anyways.
Through it.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happens. The Connachar says, no, I won't put her to death. I'll raise her to be my wife. So he secludes her so that no one else can see her, and raises her up to be his future wife. But one day she's looking out the window, and she sees Connachar's serving man flaying a goat that's going to be for dinner, and she sees a raven that's come to peck at the offal that's left there. And so she sees the red of the blood, the white of the snow, and the black of the raven, and she said, the man I would love would have all three of those colors. Lo and behold, a little while later, she sees Naois, and she sees he's got those colors. That's the man I'll love. And that's what happens. She runs away with him. And although Connachar pursues them all over Ireland and eventually to Scotland, in the end, it ends up the way that it was fated. The huge battle, Naois is killed, Connachar is shamed by these events, and Deirdre is punished by becoming the wife of the man that has killed her Naois, and she jumps from the chariot, dashes her head, and dies.
And well, a lot of it starts with her beauty, right?
Oh, yes. And in fact, there's a wonderful prophecy about exactly what her beauty would look like. And I can read you that part from one of the manuscripts. It says, a woman with twisted yellow braids of hair, green irised eyes of great beauty, and cheeks flushed like the foxglove, whiter than the snow is the white treasure of her teeth, Parthian red, her lips luster, Ulster's chariot warriors will deal many a blow for her.
But that initial image of the warrior, or the color scheme, if you will, of the warrior that she will take up with is a little foreboding, isn't it? I mean, you have a raven who is typically a symbol of death, of foreboding, of scavenging. And then the blood from the flayed goat. I mean, this is not the stuff of a love sonnet.
No, exactly. But it is the kind of ideal of a warrior, that the warriors are both perhaps handsome, but also very vigorous and powerful and good at battle. And that's what makes them attractive to these young women.
Do you find in some of these medieval love triangles some femme fatale, some women who kind of lure men in and are quite powerful and destructive?
Well, I think that in the story of Gentleman and Grania, you have that femme fatale concept because Jedma desperately doesn't want to offend Finn, and yet she comes along, and Grania says, "If you don't take me away with you, I will shame you forever." And then he has no choice. He has to take her. And in fact, he asks the other men, "What should I do?" And they say, "Well, she's pretty good looking. Take her along." So he does, and that ends the relationship with Finn that he's had.
There's multiple versions of some of these tales, too. I was thinking of with Helen of Troy, for example, going back into classical times, but then retellings of it. Sometimes Helen is portrayed as just a victim who's been abducted. Other times it seems as if she's trying to get away from her, you know, less desirable husband.
I mean, her older husband.
Right. There's just all kinds of versions of how people are portrayed.
Yeah, and I think that these different versions are part of the way that medieval writers and their audiences thought about the motivations that happened to people, the very human relationships that people entered into for good or for ill and how those worked out. And it's in any kind of love triangle, there's always blame in every direction. And I think one of the things that makes them intriguing to us as modern readers is that you can identify with virtually any one of the triangle. You can think of yourself as the woman. You can think of yourself as the jilted person. You can think of yourself as the guy who steals the girl, and you can imagine the emotions and the motivations and the complex choices that are happening on each of those scores.
Do we ever actually have any historical stories of love triangles from the Middle Ages of this nature?
We have lots of evidence that there were love triangles. And I think they're really intriguing to look at because the texts that we have are usually under royal control, and they're trying to hide or deny those things. But anyone who studies Elizabethan culture would know that Elizabeth had quite a few relationships and that those ended up often pretty fatal for the men that she
had. Well, it's kind of a role reversal there because the queen is the head of the state here.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that what Elizabeth is trying to do in her reign very carefully is to make sure that England keeps in control. And in order to do that, she can't just become the wife of Spain or the wife of some other country and let her country become enthralled, in a sense, to another kingdom.
Would you say that in most of these texts that we've been looking at, love comes off as something that makes people crazy, blind? You know, in other words, some of the images that get used, whether it's with Cupid or others, suggest a complete lack of control, wouldn't you say?
It absolutely. And I think that that's the medieval meaning of that wonderful Latin epithet, amor vincit omnia, love conquers all. That really, in the medieval sense, what it means is that I can have all the sense in the world and I can plan things correctly, but when love takes its own, it's going to win the day. Regardless of what I wanted, regardless of how carefully everything was planned, love wins the day.
Well, that's what a little later Shakespeare's having fun with in Midsummer Night's Dream, because it is, in effect, it's a potion that causes you know, young woman literally to fall in love with an ass.
Exactly.
And that seems to be kind of the ultimate statement of the arbitrary nature of this seeing and falling in love.
Exactly. Yeah, it's that thing that we often talk about in modern times as love is wasted on the young. They make bad decisions. If they only had the wisdom that we'd have today, they would do better. But it's not the case. Love hits us at different ages and is always unpredictable.
And there's the psychology of the hunt in Midsummer Night's Dream and in some of these other tales that once the object is obtained, it no longer has its value.
Exactly. Yeah, that what has all of the struggle been for, and what is going to – how do you turn that initial infatuation into a long-standing relationship? And in a way, a lot of the narratives get around that by having the lovers die as soon as they've had the
– Well, yeah, I mean that's a little bit of the trick, isn't it? Because a story about domestic bliss and routine doesn't really make good copy, as they would say in the news business, whereas the initial part of that and the hope and the misgivings and the miscarriage of a love story, that gets people's attention.
It does indeed, yeah. And it is something that becomes a kind of a warning to the audience. Be careful who you consort with, and watch out who you look at, and think about these things. But also, it creates this wish fulfillment narrative that, oh, I would love to have that kind of a romance for just 1 minute. Would I trade everything of a long and potentially tedious marriage for 1 minute of true romance that ends tragically?
What about deception? Does that play a big role in medieval love triangles? It would seem like it would be inevitable.
Well, interestingly, at least in the British Isles ones, apart from the – even in the Guinevere and Lancelot one, there isn't all that much deception. What you have more is people trying to resist their natural urges, and then once they give in, they don't care. Who notices? And there's a great moment – when Nisha has decided that he is going to run away with Deirdre, and he knows that Connor is going to get really angry, and so he stops holding Deirdre next to him and kind of does something a little lewd so that King Connor can see and says, "There, look, we're headed off." So there is this kind of realization that we're going to be enemies now because of this, so I might as well seize the day and do that in a heroic way.
Well, and certainly in Chaucer, there's a lot of deception played on the poor husbands, and the cuckold becomes kind of the butt of the joke.
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, literally
absolutely.
In the Miller's Tale.
And we have those narratives coming up. You know, Chaucer is really this kind of later period, and he's drawing a lot on the Decameron and on Italian lore. And in Italian medieval literature, you have a lot more of this kind of deception going on.
We'll look at some more medieval love triangles when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Thomas Dubois, and we are talking about medieval love triangles as we head into almost Valentine's Day. Tell us how these different tales – we've talked about the King Arthur, Lancelot, Guinevere tales, some various ones that are Welsh and so on. How do they spread from one place to the next?
Well, what's I think a really interesting aspect about these when we look at the British Isles is that there is this – what we could call the Celtic love triangle story that then spreads to the continent from the British Isles. So the Normans come in, they hear these stories, and they translate them into French, and then they bring those to the continent in medieval French. And they catch on throughout the world. And become something that is reproduced in other parts of Europe.
Were there other cultural phenomena that went that direction? It seems like most of the time it's coming from the continent, you know, Italy, for example, to England.
Most of the time, yeah, it's going in that direction. And it is interesting that it is these love stories that move in this other direction. And it's one of the great exports of the of the British Isles.
So this medieval love triangle that's being exported from the British Isles, it has the standard feature of the older husband, the beautiful wife, the handsome young warrior,
yes.
Problems for all three. Anything else that's sort of part of the, you know, the template here?
Well, the conflict between those characters and the kind of anguished decision-making that goes on is something that's really lively. But when it gets to the continent, it takes new directions too. And sometimes we have stories between two young men with a young woman and
really?
Something that we then get that's much more modern-seeming than what we had in this very state-centered or very kind of feudal framework.
Is there ever any going back? I mean, we talk about, you know, thinking through these hazardous relationships, but it seems as if they always go ahead anyway and disaster results.
Well, there are stories in which men and women make the wrong decisions, and it ends up just creating a kind of a sorrowful regret in life. There's a great example of that in Gunnlaug saga, which is a saga, kind of a late Icelandic saga, and it clearly is taking this love triangle story and taking it in new directions, and it's an interesting one to look at because it has connections to England in different ways.
What happens?
Well, in that story, you have three characters, Helga and Gunnlaug, who's a poet, and then this other poet named Ravn. And Helga and Gunnlaug have been raised together, and they've loved each other all along. But Gunnlaug is, like a lot of poets, he wants to make a name for himself. So he gets betrothed to Helga, and then he says, I'll be back in 3 years for you. And he heads off to England and Ireland and Scandinavia. He goes to Denmark and Norway and Sweden. He travels all over the place. And in each of those places, he gains fame. He recites great poems, and he gets various treasures from different monarchs. And he also makes an enemy. And the enemy he makes is this Ravn, who's also an Icelander, who's also a poet, who's trying to do the same thing. And when Ravn finds out that Gunnlaug has this girl back home, he decides, I'm going to get back to Iceland before him and marry her. That's how I'll get my revenge on Gunnlaug.
Sounds reasonable.
And what does Helga have to say about that?
Well, Helga wants to wait for Gunnlaug, but the 3 years has expired. And her father wants her to get married. And Ravn is also a good match. He's from a good family. And so she's more or less forced into that marriage. And on the day of the wedding, Gunnlaug returns.
Of course.
Yes.
It sounds like Hollywood.
Yeah, it's exactly that kind of a moment. And she realizes only after the wedding that she's been tricked, that Gunnlaug is around and that she could have married him, and now she's married to Ravn instead.
So then what?
Well, Gunnlaug comes to visit her and gives her one of the treasures that he's received from King Ethelred of England, this beautiful cloak, and she's very impressed by it. And the saga says that after she got that cloak, Ravn had no more attention from his wife ever again. So she's clearly realized what's happened, and she's angry, and their relationship is at an end. So actually, Ravn challenges Gunnlaug to a duel, and they fight this duel. It's said to be the last duel ever fought in Iceland on this particular island where duels were supposed to happen. And in it, both men are wounded a little bit, and so it's not clear that who's won this duel. So they say, well, what do? We'll have a second duel, But the Icelanders say, no, dueling is over. We're a Christian nation now. No more of this fighting. So they make the deal that they'll go off to Norway and have a duel there. Yeah. So they travel off, each going in their own way. And they have this wonderful duel, this battle. And in the battle, it's almost kind of a Monty Python kind of a moment because Gunnlaug swings with the sword and he cuts the leg off Ravan.
Just a flesh wound.
Yeah, just a flesh wound. You know, you have to really swing hard with the sword to lop off a whole leg. And Ravan doesn't die. He finds a tree stump and he props himself up on it. And he's standing there kind of uncertain, and he says, I'll be fine if you just get me a little water. And Gunnlaug says, if I take off my helmet and bring you some water to drink, will you promise that you'll do nothing to me? And we'll have a little time out, in other words. And Ravan says, I promise. So Gunnlaug gets some water. He brings it in his helmet, and he's letting this enemy drink from his helmet. And Ravan takes his sword and smites Gunnlaug on the head and gives him a death wound. So now they're both going to die. In fact, they continue to have the battle. Ravan is killed definitively, and our friend Gunnlaug dies 3 days later. But as he's received this wound, he says to Ravan, why did you do that? We had a deal. We had
right,
a truce.
Well, right, yes.
You've betrayed your honor and mine by doing this. And Ravan says, I did it so that you'll never enjoy the embrace of Helga. So ultimately, you know, that happens. But then what happens to Helga? She dash her head like the characters that we have in England. She doesn't die of a broken heart. She, in fact, her father marries her off to another guy and she has lots of kids. But the saga says that her fondest moment was that she would take out this cloak that she received from Gunnlaug, and she would look at it for a long time.
But she never had any time with him then.
She never had any moment.
Well, you know, in a way, that's maybe the most modern of the stories you've told us, because in terms of the psychology or the psychological depth of the female in the story, she does marry somebody else, but she always has this memory that perhaps is more important to her than her day-to-day life.
Or even more than a memory, it's almost a vision of what might be.
What might have been.
But never got ruined by reality.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it is the most modern in the sense that we can see in the Middle Ages the portrayal of these relationships and the portrayal of women going from the very most stereotyped and simplistic image that we have of Wiathio being the good queen, doing what she's supposed to do, up to Helga, where we're really looking at the motivations of individuals and the desires that they have and complex emotions like regret.
How do we know then that we're leaving the Middle Ages in terms of the way these love triangles are treated?
Well, I think what you can see in Gunnlaug's saga that's interesting is that the families exist in a sense. They help arrange marriages to meet the emotional needs of the members.
So the emotional needs rather than, say, a family need or a national need.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's a more romantic love.
Alliances. It's romantic love is first. And that is what I think marks the shift towards what we could think of as a modern concept of romance.
And does that idea then come from Italy or somewhere on the continent, or is it generated in the British Isles?
I think it's something that develops on the continent through the taking of this British Isles model and then examining it in different ways. And also culture is changing at that time, and the roles of states and the roles of kings and kingdoms are changing. So we no longer have the king quite as a embodiment of the state so much as a human leader who's got his own family life and might be might be positive and might be messy, but that doesn't really have as much to do with the state as it did in the early medieval
period. So we're really
period.
Just getting more depth of character.
Yeah, we're moving towards a notion of human relationships that is more like what we know people to be.
When I think of all the more modern triangles like Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary and so many others where there's not necessarily one villain and one hero, but very
right.
complex, three complex characters.
Right. And that's what I think we come to value in the modern story is not these stereotyped, simplistic narratives, but the more complex, nuanced stories in which nobody's perfectly blameless and nobody's perfectly proper either.
Well, it sounds like a great way to celebrate Valentine's Day this time around, looking at some of these medieval love triangles and how they develop into our contemporary world. Thanks for joining us, Tom Dubois.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure. I'm Norman Gilliland, and I hope you'll join Emily Auerbach and me for the next hour of University of the Air.